week, investors chose the sidelines ahead of next week's big FOMC meeting. Hello, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek. It's just great to be back with you this weekend. We have another Muy Grande size show in this doubleheader. The first at the plate, John Embry, batting 380, the chief investment strategist at Sprott Asset Management, returns to the show with his latest thoughts on the precious metals sector. He says the pullback is a grand slam opportunity to pick up value through dollar cost averaging. Then next, bringing the runners all across home plate, Richard Doughty, a.k.a. the Magambo, returns to the show with his latest thoughts on the impending rate hikes. Savvy investors have learned the lesson of history, he says, by adding gold and silver investments to their portfolios. And we'd like for you to record your questions and comments on the hotline 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Please leave your first name, or you can stay anonymous if you like. The QE hotline, 1-206-666-65370. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Heavy cloud cover appeared over the New York COMEX exchange this week as next week's Fed meeting sent investors to the sidelines. The news sent gold lower, ending down only 34, though, about 3% at $10.98 a share. Silver fell 10 cents, about 1%, finishing around $14.71 an ounce. The XEU gold and silver index, though, finished off about 6 points, nearly 11%, down at 54, while West Texas Intermediate crude also dropped $3, about 6%, ending at 48 per barrel. Well, on Thursday, the Labor Department said the number of Americans filing initial applications for unemployment fell to a 42-year low. That's right, the lowest reading since 1973. First-time claims fell by about 26,000 to 255,000. The unemployment rate is steady at a 7-year low of 5.3%, and the economy has added 3 million jobs just in the last year, which is likely to add upward momentum to national output for the remainder of the year. Economists expect around 2.5% in the second quarter, quite an improvement following the first quarter, which saw a slight contraction. Next week, the Federal Open Market Committee holds its July meeting to decide the fate of the benchmark lending rate. My official stance remains 2 rate hikes this year, and then we're done for a while. One at the upcoming September meeting, and one again in December. And given the continued improvement in the overall economy, at least on paper, with unemployment and inflation at or near target levels, there doesn't seem to be any major reason to think the Fed won't finally pull the trigger on at least a 0.5 point rate hike before the end of this year. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, signs of capitulation were seen in the market this week, ranging from gold, silver, and the XEU. My subscribers know that I've forecasted the current smash since the beginning of May, so the Alpha Stock subscribers have had 2 months of early warnings on the impending breakdown. Although a bounce, I think, is likely from a technical vantage point, I do expect gold to approach at least $1,000 an ounce in the next few weeks to months, presenting even more solid buying opportunities for long-term portfolio value. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, heavy cloud cover appeared over the New York Stock Exchange this week as investors chose the sidelines ahead of the upcoming FOMC meeting. The Dow Jones Industrials Average ended off about 3%, 18,086, down 517 points for the week. The S&P ended at 2079, off 47 points, about 2.2%, while the NASDAQ finished off 122, down 2.3%, finishing at 5088. Last week's explosive rally was met with an equally disappointing bout of profit-taking, due in part to sluggish oil prices, which rattled some of the major components in the S&P 500, as well as the Dow Jones Industrials. But the news wasn't all bleak. An Alpha Stocks newsletter candidate, CVS Pharmacy, hit a new high this week, while shares of Regeneron touched a new all-time high on news that the Federal Drug Administration approved the Fed's new cholesterol drug on a limited scale. In related news, Anthem announced a buyout deal this week of Cigna, amounting to a $54 billion deal, the largest U.S. health insurer now, according to one media report. Amazon added 10% on unexpected quarterly profits. The market cap now exceeds the brick-and-mortar retail chain Walmart. That's right, the market cap of Amazon, AMZN, ticker, now larger than Walmart. Credit card company Visa and coffee retailer Starbucks blasted higher to new record highs after topping earnings estimates as well. Bottom line on Wall Street, fear is reaching extreme levels. That, according to our 7-component fear index, after just one down week. This is not really the type of investor psychology we tend to see near a typical market peak. The selling should be met with greed, not fear, if this were really the end of this 6-year bull market. Wouldn't be surprised at all to see some heavy-duty accumulation in the next week or two. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio right here with you with John Embry and the Magambo Guru. Stay with us here at GoldSeek. John Embry, industry expert in precious metals for over 3 decades, portfolio management specialist as well. Since the 1960s, he's a senior advisor at Sprott Asset Management and a favorite of this show. Welcome back, sir.
Nice to chat with you again, Chris.
It's nice of you to say, and we have been looking forward to having you back here on the show because there's a lot going on in the markets. The Eurozone troubled by this Grexit. They're going to open the banks, you know, open the doors again. The ATMs will start to flow. That peripheral nation is on the verge of an exit. And a lot of people are concerned that this could have a domino-like effect across several other debt-plagued neighbors. I mean, and that could spill over and even have a global impact.
Well, you know, that's a really interesting conundrum, Greece, because to me, it's an insoluble problem. You have a totally bankrupt country. And you have the Eurozone, who basically can't allow them to leave because there's just too much Greek debt and there's all sorts of derivatives written on it. So they keep dancing around and, you know, basically, I don't know what the outcome's going to be, but one of the other things they're deeply afraid of, and you alluded to it, is that if there were a Grexit, then, I mean, the Spaniards and the Portuguese and the Italian populations would start to say, well, how come we're going through all this austerity? And why don't we possibly leave as well? So it's a very destabilizing factor. The end remains to be seen, but I can't see a very positive outcome over time.
You know, if we look at this, step back a minute, gain some perspective. This is, at best case, a partnership. This is a problem between lender and borrower, but it's also, I think, an issue of extending excessive easy money to people who maybe don't have a societal foundation in place that demands the repayment. Differences in cultural backgrounds and whatnot with regard to debt. There's a lot of animosity and ambiguity regarding debt. It just seems to me as though lenders have been a bit unscrupulous. And I think a lot of that is because much of the mainline media is owned by people who have it in their best interest to keep perpetuating this debt cycle that we're all caught up in.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, I have a philosophy, and I've always had it, but it's obviously not shared by the Eurocrats, that if you lend somebody money, it's incumbent upon you to make sure they can pay you back. That's the way I've always approached life. I mean, I'm taking a risk if I lend you money, so I better do the due diligence and make sure you can pay me back. Well, I mean, not only did they sort of lend Greece a whole bunch of money before 2010, when it became apparent at that point they couldn't repay it, they just kept piling more debt on them. There's nobody looks good in this situation. I mean, a lot of the criticism of Greece, they don't work hard enough, they retire too early, their pensions are inflated, nobody pays taxes, etc. I think they're all basically, there's truth in it. But when they lent them the money, they knew that. So, I mean, basically, it's incumbent upon, I think, the Eurozone to come up with some debt settlement that can allow Greece to recover. They can't recover carrying this much debt.
Iceland, I think, is just an important piece of this puzzle here because they faced similar debt disaster there. It would have just taken most of their country underwater, you know, the tiny island. These were unscrupulous debts. We're writing it off. We will not pay you back and will not allow you to destroy us and this nation. And now they've taken the pain and are emerging. I hope that officials see this as a potential blueprint.
It's interesting because, you know, people say, well, Iceland's very small, that you can do it with a country the size of Iceland. There's less than 1 million people there. But nevertheless, they were the victim of unscrupulous lending. I can't remember. I think it was the Dutch and English banks just poured astounding amounts of debt into that country. And they couldn't handle it. And I think that's the right outcome. But you see, if you want to extend that further, Chris, I think that ultimately, before this is all over, and I think it's going to take some time, there's going to be a major sort of reneging on the debt globally. We've got in roughly $200 trillion worth of debt globally, $60 trillion of which has been created since the global financial crisis. These numbers are outrageous. There's no way on earth we can go forward with that sort of debt burden.
This idea that there's less than a million folks, they're not a major threat. You know, I think we could turn that on its head. This is David and Goliath. They stood up with no military force whatsoever, no political power throughout the Eurozone or worldwide, essentially just a spot on the North Atlantic map. It was the traditional lending practice to press the flesh, shake the hand of those that you are going to be lending money to. The local banker, they knew your background, they knew where you went to school, they knew half the people you grew up with, and they knew your neighbors because they were all clients and patrons of the bank, and they might be in the same synagogues or churches. And this, you know, made for a much more sound lending system. But with the advent of this collateralization, where CDOs, MDOs, mortgage-backed securities are all packaged up, tranched, sliced and diced, and sent around the world via Wall Street, it just eliminates the risk for almost everyone except who it matters to the most. We better get on to our topic du jour, and that's the precious metals. People are concerned about Dr. Yellen and company at the Fed looking for a rate hike in September and another maybe quarter point in December, two and done. Give us an idea on what you think this could mean for the markets, please.
Number one, they keep talking about rate increases. And then out of the other side of their mouth, they say, but it's going to be data dependent. I happen to be of the mind that the U.S. economy isn't nearly as strong as the authorities would have you believe. I'm a great fan of John Williams of Shadow Stats, among other people. And, I mean, there's a lot of evidence that the U.S. economy is flagging here. And the last thing they probably need is a rate increase. And I suspect I have a very different view on if they did have a rate increase. I think that might actually be bullish for gold because I think it would probably put the economy and the financial system at even greater risk. So I'm not concerned about it. I mean, you've had interest rates fall to almost zero, and yet the gold price has fallen from 1900 to 1100. So I don't think it's a problem. And the other thing I'll bring up is that in the late 1970s, when gold had its run to 875, interest rates were going through the roof.
And it took at least 5 or 6 years of rate hikes, culminating in 1980
with the Volcker, when he really squashed the inflationary psychology out of the system and set up, you know, about 30 years of financial asset inflation. But the fact is, I mean, you can't possibly raise rates. This is, you know, this zero-based interest rate thing we're dealing with is the exact result of too much debt in the world. If they want to crush the debt burden, just raise rates to any degree.
Oh, that's right. And one really wonders if this isn't just saber-rattling anyway.
Oh, I believe it is. I believe it's moral suasion to sort of keep sort of a bid in the U.S. dollar.
The ramifications of even marginally higher rates, at least $300 trillion in notional derivatives exposure to interest rates or interest-sensitive exposure in our six leading money center banks here just in the contiguous United States, as well as all throughout the Western world. I mean, the implications are staggering to any type of even relative increase in rates, and plus any type of nascent recovery that we've experienced in the economic output would just be decimated because you'd see the housing sector implode, which is arguably 60-70%, I think, of the recovery that we've seen. So, I mean, with new housing starts going through the roof, obviously we're putting millions of people back to work. Those jobs would evaporate. Give us an idea just what you see on the horizon. Any topicality that we haven't covered today?
I think we've got to keep a very close eye here on the gold and silver prices. I mean, they're trading at remarkably low levels in comparison to what you can dig them out of the ground for. There is massive open interest on the COMEX and the LBMA, and there's no inventory if anybody ever called these contracts. So I think it's one of these things that they put enormous pressure on gold overnight. As you know, there was $2.7 billion of paper contracts dropped in about 2 minutes, and then the price dropped $50. I mean, this is leading to a very large bottom. And when gold finally goes the other way, I think it's going to be violent to the upside. So I would encourage your listeners, you know, not to be dismayed by this sort of short-term action, because I think it's unsustainable.
Well, you know, I think it's almost cliche to talk about dollar cost averaging, but in my discussions with Princeton Emeritus Economist Dr. Burton Malkiel, author of Random Walk, over the long term, if you will just get over this natural human tendency to want to outthink the markets, to command the waves, command the tides. If you accept the fact that we just can't most of the time, sure, there's always pockets of probability where one can get a pivot point in the markets and whatnot. Find me on one hand the number of people that you've seen grow rich that way.
I don't have a problem with dollar cost averaging, particularly when you've got an item that's inexpensive. And I mean, when you look at gold and silver today, I would argue that they're probably the most inexpensive assets on the planet, and yet they're the ones under the most downward price pressure. So I think dollar cost averaging at this point into these, because you can't pick bottoms. But I mean, it would be brilliant, because most other assets are not cheap.
We've just seen so much deleveraging over the past few years. I mean, sure, it's been a difficult time. Many people had just bid up, and the momentum just turned the other way into the risk-off trade, as we've seen in U.S. equities. But at some point, you know, that momentum will shift.
Oh, it's going to shift violently. I mean, that's why I say you've got to be very, very careful with the way you're positioned today, because if you're all financial assets and no real assets, I think you could get badly hurt at some point in the not-too-distant future.
And if that sounds like talking one's book, take a look at China. If we look at the Shanghai Exchange, we watched equities plunge by, I think it was close to peak to trough, just over 30% on the Shanghai Exchange.
Correct. I think they'd still be plunging if the government hadn't put in all these amazing rules, like you can't short sell, and so many these people have to buy. And it's really quite remarkable the extent to which they went to try to stop this carnage. But the problem is the stocks were hugely overpriced, and there was far too much debt margin buying employed to basically get the market up like it was. You got to be really careful. I mean, I think the U.S. margin debt's about as high as it's ever been in history, too. So I would be very wary of sort of piling in at this point.
I think it's a great point. And as we wrap up here, I'd just like to note that, you know, I think we forget sometimes, and even in the industry, that, you know, people are chasing return. They have no choice. When governments hold rates artificially low, you know, savers, retirees, widowers require that passive income, are nearly forced into a gambling, speculative state because there just is no return to be found anywhere.
Well, I think that might be part of the strategy of our peerless leaders. And I mean, this financial repression which is going on, it's punished anybody that's done the right thing through the years. They've saved for investment and what have you. And now they're being forced into speculative activity.
I wonder if you could give us an idea about some of the services that our listeners can find at Sprott Asset Management and any other contact information that you'd like to share with the listeners today.
Well, now you can go to our website, sprott.com. And I think that, you know, we're well known for our precious metal expertise, but we're a full service operation. We have, you know, bonds, stocks, and everything else. I would encourage people to take a look at our offerings, and they go to sprott.com.
Excellent. Well, there's a lot to glean and to gain from the website. So we're going to make sure that there's plenty of links available for our listening audience and subscribers. Thank you for your time, and please return to the show.
Chris, it's always a pleasure. I'd be glad to talk to you anytime.
Richard Daughtry, the Magambo Guru, publishes the Magambo Guru Economic Newsletter. Welcome back, Richard.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful to be here, Chris.
A lot of volatility in the markets following more drama from the Eurozone. We also have concerns from the Federal Reserve that there could be some rate hikes, and that tends to be weighing on the markets as well.
They are desperate to keep this market up. Everybody's money is all in the stock market and the bond market, and they're going to make absolutely sure nothing goes wrong. I mean, they bought up General Motors stock. I mean, they bought up all the stuff. They can just buy up all the stock in the world. They can create all the money they want. They can buy up everything that literally exists. That's how much money they can create. So they have the wherewithal to keep anything from going down.
You're thinking it's two and done situation. So September, December, maybe they pull the trigger a couple of times, raise it 0.5% or so, and see, we did what we said we were going to do. We've saved face. But, you know, they do have a target, Richard, for a long-term rate of around 2-3%. And it kind of makes you wonder whether or not they'll actually follow through with it. Because as you, I think, point out, they might be shooting themselves in the foot. I mean, after all, they bought up, as you pointed to, $5 trillion worth of toxic debt and government bonds. They're just lowering the value of the debt they purchased if they let rates go.
You know, when you put it in so many words like that, Chris, it does sound even more ludicrous than even just thinking the thing.
We're collectively scratching our heads as investors. What are they up to now?
The big money boys, they have a lot on the line, too, and they're going to make sure that the government is going to make sure that the Federal Reserve is going to make sure that nothing happens to all this. Everything is in the stock market. Your IRAs, your 401Ks, your SEPs, everything is in the stock market. They can't have half of people's wealth going down. They sweep every bit of money out of the banks every night into the bond market. I mean, come on, they're going to let something happen to these markets at the same time as this euro is imploding, as everyone knew that it would.
Their hands are kind of tied, but I guess they have to raise the rates now. The markets have certainly discounted a rate hike. If they follow through with it, it's obviously, wouldn't you agree, it must be 90% of the U.S. dollars, a spectacular 12-month rally or so here, because higher rates makes the greenback look relatively more attractive. It's the least sick patient in the ward, I guess.
This kind of thing's been going on between economies and governments for over 2,000 years. This is the same thing that always happens at the end. The government has borrowed itself into debt. They can't get out. They don't know what to do. They're going to thrash around doing everything they can to try to stave this thing off as far as they can, thinking that somehow, some miracle this time, for some reason that no one ever thought of before, even though Isaac Newton was drafted to try to get England out of one of its messes, he couldn't come up with anything. They think that this time somebody's going to come up with something. It's not going to happen. They're just going to flail around until it falls apart. And they're going to have one of those false flag things. We're all going to go to war. They'll blame you'll be unpatriotic for thinking about your bank account. There's just no way out of this mess. The money has been lost. Someone is going to have to take the pipe. So it basically comes down to who. And there's not anybody with that kind of money. In fact, I was just reading notional value of derivatives outstanding just in U.S. banks, as I understand it, is over $250 billion. $250 billion. The GDP of, 17 trillion, and this is quadrillions of dollars.
I think what Egon von Greitz, actually, it's a quarter of a quadrillion dollars.
Only after they marked it down from the notional value to the expected value at maturity, whereas the actual, when you take a look at it notionally, it's a $1.5 quadrillion.
Instead of just the interest rate exposure, which has roughly been estimated around $250 trillion with a T dollars. Of course, he would be referring to our five or six major money center banks, such as Bank of America. The last time the financial experts got it not so right, they just put the rest of us on the hook for who knows how many trillions of dollars. So it could happen again, is what the Magambo is saying here.
It's going to happen again. There's just no way out of this thing. If there was, someone would have thought of it before this. Spent a lot of time trying to find a way out of this, too. I'd like to go down in history as the guy who has figured out how to get out of this mess. And I can't do it. No one can do it. It can't be done. And so
they want a magic bullet.
That's right. They want Well, it reminds me of a cartoon I saw one time. This guy was had a chalkboard there full of equations that went out, leading down to the bottom right-hand corner where it said, then a miracle happens.
Divine intervention. That's the very basis of Deus Ex Machina. I mean, a miracle is what they're looking for. That's, of course, from the Greek drama where they would lower through a machina, a machine, a crane, the divinity onto the play, into the play, and he would have the magic elixir.
And what was the magic elixir that he did? He put everything back like it was. Put everything back like it was because the plot had become so helplessly entangled, and there's no way out of that mess, and so he just put it back like it was. You just can't do that in real life. That's the problem.
Such a tangled mess that even divine intervention is hopeless.
I'm not going to completely discount divine intervention, but I am not banking on it.
Where you might jump into the icy North Atlantic waters hoping that someone throws you a lifeliner or something, but you could have just taken one with you.
Exactly, Chris. Exactly.
So you're saying, you know, we have a life vest, if you will. We have that security, and interestingly enough, it's on sale, much to our dismay, or I guess to our glee, depending on our position. You're still holding on to your precious metal.
You bet I am. That's the lesson of history. This kind of thing's happened time and time again, hundreds of times, thousands of times. Country after country, tens of thousands of countries have done this. They bar themselves and they try to get out of the mess, and they can't. But what happens after that? Well, part of the end game is when the government tries to confiscate everything from everybody and people can get away with their silver and gold because it's so portable. Land is not portable. Houses are not portable. Factories and businesses are not really all that portable. It's gold and silver are. And so that's usually what exactly happened. There's a big scramble for silver and gold because of its intrinsic value. Nothing else has any intrinsic value, really. But silver and gold do, only because it always has. It always has, and people always recognize its value. And now it's on such a bargain. How can I not be beating the table to get people to buy gold and silver at these gigantically bargain rates? It's astonishing that they're as low as they are. But Chris Powell, they've got the documentation that the government is suppressing all the commodities markets and not only keeping up the stock and bond markets, but they're keeping down silver and gold. So the government is everywhere, and so they're handing people a big gift. Well, the problem is how soon will it pay off? I mean, if you're 80 years old and it's going to take 15 years to pay off, well, you know, you start thinking about this. But if you're in your 20s and 30s, man, it's the argument for buying silver and gold is compelling.
Well, at least we may have taken the circuitous route, but I think we got to where we need to be here. We want folks to be prepared. Hey, Richard, tell people what else is going on with the Magambo Guru, please.
What else is there, Chris? It's idyllic. Golly. Throw a little golf in there. Come on. You got to play golf. Well, you know, I used to play at a golf course, or one of the holes it was built up. They put a high-rise building between the tee box and then the green, and people would try to hit over it, and they broke so many windows in the thing that they replaced all the windows with shatterproof glass.
People wondered why, you know, new tenants and prospective buyers wondered why, for some reason, you know, the office space on one side of the building was so much less expensive than the other. Oh, we got a bargain. Richard Doughty, just enjoy lovely, sunny, warm, beautiful Florida.
Well, thank you very much, Chris, and thank you very much for having me on your show. It's always a pleasure and an honor to be here.
Our featured guest today has over 25 years of investment experience, author of several bestsellers, and we'll let him get into all the details of the latest and near the end of this broadcast. How's the weather today, Dr. Stephen Lieb in the New York area?
Well, you know, Chris, if you had called me about an hour and a half ago, I would have said it was sunny and really beautiful. Now it appears to be getting overcast, and I hear we're going to get very, very cold weather coming in pretty soon. Days, I mean, really, really cold weather.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, maybe it's the last, you know, shots over the bow before spring. Let's certainly hope.
Yes, yes, that could be it.
Very good. Well, I wanted to begin, if we could, today with the U.S. equities markets. This is what people want to hear about. We had Dr. Burton Malkiel on recently. He claims
We're way extended when he looks at his CAPE index, the Case-Shiller price-to-earnings metric. He's just concerned that over the long term, we'll see more of a return to the mean, that the pendulum is likely to swing back towards reality. Any comments here?
Well, I think that, you know, you have to start out with the assumption or the realization that most of the models of the stock market have been based upon, the period probably beginning in 1929 and going through beginning of the century or mid-century, et cetera. And I think we're now in a entirely different period. And I think what's high and what's low and what defines valuation, et cetera, are really different rules that apply. I'm not sure that we understand all the rules quite yet, and I'm not sure, you know, that they're fully in place yet, but I am pretty sure that we're in a world that's changing in a fairly dramatic way. And, a very good friend of mine who's been enormously successful at a lot of different things, among them making money, classifies today as the most disturbing time in modern history, literally. That I think is a quote from him, most disturbing time in modern history. And, you know, it's somebody that he's not always right. No one is. But, you know, he's got a historian's perspective on things. And I think that, you know, it is a very disturbing time. It's an exceptionally disturbing time. I mean, you know, you just look at what's going on in Europe. Between the haves and have-nots, whether you're talking about in a military sense, which is certainly the case between Russia and the Ukraine, or you're talking about it in an economic sense, which is the case with Germany and Greece, you just know that there's a lot of situations in the world right now which are, you know, all possible points of inflection, and all could lead to I don't want to say chaos, but could lead to, you know, major changes. I continue to believe that, China is, that things are gravitating from west to east, that things are headed toward China. They appear to be best positioned, in my opinion, for what could be an entirely new and different type of world than one we've experienced up to now. We, meaning those that, you know, were alive at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution and, you know, up to people that are alive today.
You talk about reaching a threshold, an inflection point, a pivot point, where that chaotic system might just tip, you know, that tipping point that chaos theorists are.
Yeah.
And I think this is so key because you're echoing the sentiments of so many of the great guests we've been fortunate enough to have on the show. Everyone has a different perspective, but the arrows are starting to line up in the same vector here. And I wonder if you might try to look forward and give us an idea of what that tipping point might be.
It could be something as small, and I say small as the economic equivalent might be, you know, Greece leaving the European Union, the Eurozone. I don't think they'll necessarily leave it this time, but, Greece with its 50% youth unemployment rate and Germany, which is running, you know, not full throttle, but certainly doing extremely well, they really can't be in the same monetary system and, really share the same currency. It just doesn't make sense. And, you know, tipping point could be they're dropping out. A tipping point could be, a bigger war in the Ukraine, and, you know, a tipping point could be, you know, ISIS making headway into Saudi Arabia, or the Houthis making a headway into Saudi Arabia. I mean, there are so many areas of the world where we are extremely vulnerable, not just in a geopolitical sense, but also in an economic sense. And I do think that we're headed for a world in which the dollar will no longer reign supreme. I think we're going to head back toward some sort of metallic monetary standard, one in which gold and its correlates, have a much more active role to play. You know, I'm not sure exactly what that'll look like right now, but, you know, I would guess something, you know, along the lines of Bretton Woods. And it just seems inevitable to me that that's where we're going. And I think that, That's why I'm writing my next book, just basically as a case for gold and, you know, how we got into this situation. I mean, America has become a country in which, you know, there's no more long term in America. Everything is short term. Everything is, you know, today's success. And, you know, how have you done, you know, in the last 10 minutes? This is not the way to plan out a century or plan out, you know, another 20 or 50 years. This is just, you know, instant gratification. And that's been a long time coming. You know, we were a country that, you know, really cherished our savings and our ability to, you know, use our savings to invest, et cetera. That's just gone by the wayside, Chris.
This is a first. You know, in nearly a decade here on the show weekly, I think that was the first time a guest has proposed a new Bretton Woods-like agreement. Europe was the straw man at that meeting, and of course the United States was the giant in the room. This time, China and other BRIC nations perhaps dominating.
You would. I mean, it's not so much BRIC nations per se, but it's, yeah, I mean, it would certainly be China. And I think the Eurasia and perhaps parts of Eastern Europe, maybe even extending as far as Germany, you know, would be the kind of block you'd be looking at. As I said, everything's moving east. I mean, the data that I think I saw yesterday, I mean, you can mention it, but I just wanted people to realize I'm not 100% sure. But I believe that China bought all the gold that was available, all the gold that was mined, and that could have been bought in January. They're obviously accumulating literally as much gold as there is out there to be accumulated. At least they did in January, and I think all along they've been accumulating tremendous amounts of gold. I mean, the numbers you see from China have all been coming out of Hong Kong. But now China has their own gold exchanges, and an awful lot of that gold that is traded on that exchange ends up, you know, it is gold bars in either Chinese banks or, you know, wherever, stored, et cetera. I have no idea how much gold China has, but I think it's a lot more than upper-end guesses would suggest. You know, they're preparing very deliberately, very relentlessly for, you know, a new type of world order, a new world order.
Well, I think you really hit the nail on the head with the PBOC and their precious metals operations. We have simply no idea. It's a big wild card how much of the metal has been accumulated because, as I'm sure you know, they only give us a glimpse into that. I think it's every 5 years. You know, 2015 started out similarly to 2014. We had gold, silver moving sharply higher in tandem. And then January marked the best monthly gain yet again for the yellow metal this year, due in no small part, I'm sure you'd probably concur, with global currency issues. You know, we saw the madness in Switzerland, trouble in Greece. I wonder if you might give us an idea of whether or not this could be the year that we do find the floor.
I think there's a good chance we found the floor or have come very close to the floor, you know, in the 1100s for gold. I guess mid, low 1100s. I don't think we'll go much below that. In fact, I don't even think we'll, you know, we may have already tested that. The real question for me, and tested successfully, the real question for me is when do we start, you know, the new and great bull market, one that I think could take us all the way up to 10,000. I doubt that it'll be this year. I think more likely next year or 2017, something like that. But it's going to happen. And when it does happen, it's going to be, you'll know it. I mean, there'll be no doubt it's happening.
That's an interesting point, and you just sparked this memory for some reason. You might recall over history, we've had a tendency for, particularly during the 90s, that is, where we had more liberal-oriented administrations in place. Stocks simply outperformed virtually every other asset. And then when more conservatives came into play in the Oval Office, of course, you saw the commodities simply skyrocket. Tends to be a correlation there. So it's interesting that your 2016-2017 thesis coincides with the most likely change in the guard, if you will, in party lines.
There could be. I mean, you know, a definite change in the guard. And a change in the guard would be one that, you know, is not so favorably disposed toward the Fed. And if that's the case, you know, ironically, you're going to see big deficits in the government budget, probably used to induce growth rather than just, you know, throw money away. Those growth-oriented policies, which I think you will see if you've got a change in government would probably set the stage for a lot more inflation, commodity scarcity. And you're certainly going to see that in India, and I think you're going to see it more than people expect in China. So, yeah, I think the stage could be set for, that's a good point about the election, 2016, 2017, depending on, you know, how that turns out. A president from the other party would ironically be more, would be more disposed toward growth created by, let's say, industry-government partnerships rather than just the Fed. I mean, you know, we're in a world right now in which the Fed writes and controls monetary policy completely. European Central Bank, the Federal Reserve Board, I mean, these are the two most important policymakers in the world today. You know, my guess is I'm not taking a moral or a political making a moral or political judgment on this, but I don't think that this has resulted in great things. I mean, I think that you've got, you know, vast inequalities across the globe, and countries inequalities are enormous. And, you know, the other day, Jeb Bush went to Michigan, and I think that's a state a Republican hasn't carried probably since Romney or someone, presidential candidate, maybe Reagan carried, I'm not sure. But, and he spoke about, you know, the middle classes and bringing growth back, boosting the middle classes. Well, you're not, obviously not going to do that with zero interest rates, just not working. You may have a, you know, a completely new calculus for governing the economy than the one we've been operating under the last six and what promises to be 8 years. And it could be very interesting.
Well, you brought up one of my favorite topics, calculus. So give us integration by parts. Give us the derivative here. Give us the double integration where we can revitalize the middle class. I would like for us to evaluate the integral in such a way that it can reestablish the heartland and the backbone of the United States.
It starts and ends with infrastructure. You know, this massive infrastructure deficit. I mean, and I think it will be, you know, infrastructure that is the key buzzword for the next at least decade, maybe next generation. You know, you're talking about a need for, you know, many, many, many trillions of dollars of infrastructure spending to, you know, get the world on a fairly decent foundation, pardon the pun. I think that's where, you know, money will be spent. And it's interesting that this world of ours, or at least this country of ours, has morphed from a so-called military-industrial complex, which had its own problems under Eisenhower. I mean, that was Eisenhower's, I think, farewell speech, where he referred to the military-industrial complex and that we have to watch this. And he's right. You do. There are risks to a military-industrial complex. But we've gone too far in the other direction. And, you know, what we have now, rather than a military-industrial complex, I think we have a financial-legal complex. Finance and legal and lawyers and investment bankers really do very little in terms of creating real productivity in the economy and creating the kinds of infrastructure that allow transportation to flow, that allow water to flow, that allow for cheaper energy and more sustainable energies. You know, it's these kinds of things and these kinds of goals that I think China gets and has been, you know, very busy implementing that we just don't have any clues about. I mean, we tend to be very short-sighted, and I think one of my favorite examples has become, you know, the idea of a wind turbine. You know, a wind turbine, how it takes a while to build. There's a tremendous upfront cost. And, you know, so you're building something, you're spending a lot of money, and you're not getting anything in return right away. You sometimes have to wait years. But, you know, at the end of a certain period of time, you've got a massive amount of free energy, you know, for, you know, 20, 30 years. Yeah. We don't approach things in that fashion. We want results here and now. And I think that has to change. We have to become much more long-term oriented in this country in order to really, you know, create something good. And I think there's a good chance we will. The Chinese certainly get it. And I think, you know, they're going to take a lot of their Asian and Eurasian partners along with them. Even places like Saudi Arabia, China's been involved in creating renewable energies there, solar energy in Saudi Arabia, believe it or not. It's changing, and we're going to have to take a lesson from the East if we're going to keep up and want to be you know, a significant part of the new economic structure.
Integrating into that structure, I think, will pose incredible challenges. It's going to require leadership.
I think it's going to require much higher caliber leadership. I think that we have to take lessons from China without becoming enamored of China. And, you know, one of the lessons that you take from China is you go back to Confucius, which is, what, 2,500 years ago, something like that. I mean, he's still there. I mean, you know, people still, you know, quote Confucius. He's part of the body politic in China right now, you know, has been for the last 2,500 years. And, you know, he was the one that brought up the idea of a meritocracy. Now, China's not a complete meritocracy. We all know that. I mean, you know, she's been very busy rooting out corruption. But I think we have to buy more into that idea that people are equal. Give everybody a chance. Give people more of a chance and be long viewed in terms of doing things. A lot of what, you know, China does, they are long viewed. They're meritocratic. It's the kind of stuff that we used to do. And we used to do it really, really well. But we've sort of lost our way over the past, well, I, you know, honestly would date it in the very early 70s, we lost our way. It was like once we went off the gold standard and we remained the reserve currency in the world, I mean, we sort of had our cake and could eat it too, spend whatever we wanted, and really didn't have to answer to anyone. There were no constraints on what we could do, and we did everything. I think we've got to get back to a much more disciplined way of life in order to you know, really succeed. But I think there's a good chance that we will, a very good chance.
Studying last night China's history, we all know gunpowder, all these amazing scientific achievements that emanated from that land. But fewer folks, I think, realize that it was initially an elixir given to the emperors to extend longevity. That's the origins of saltpeter as we know it today. We can learn and we can adjust and we can adapt and we must. And I think you've underscored and highlighted that so well. So let me shift over here to a related topic, and that is exchange-traded funds, the ETPs. They are showing huge inflows relative to the last 3 years of the yellow metal. Folks are stepping up. They want to add that gold to their portfolios. The ETFs have to accumulate huge bullion bars. Do you see this as a fundamental shift, a sea change that could bode well?
I mean, I see it's certainly part of a sea change. I mean, the last thing people would expect in the face of a dollar, which has been on a, you know, near historic tear. I mean, you know, just absolutely rising in a, you know, massive way. The last thing people would expect would be a gold rally, a strong gold market. I mean, you know, typically there's the association reflexive it may be, but there's still this association between a strong dollar and weak gold and a strong dollar. So that, I mean, and weak dollar, strong gold. But to see the dollar and gold both, you know, firm together is very unusual and really does suggest that gold is ignoring the quote bad news of the strong dollar. And I think that's very positive for the yellow metal. It is extremely positive.
People that I read online and elsewhere are pointing to the crude oil implosion and bracing for a commodity market implosion, and particularly the precious metals. But, you know, I can't help but wonder if maybe that is short-sighted, pointing back to 2007, 2008. Crude oil had its big run and then collapsed, and the credit crisis seemed to follow. But I don't see that occurring this time, and I wonder if you share those thoughts.
I think that low oil prices are, you know, they're a mixed bag in the U.S., but, you know, more positive than negative. I don't see any, you know, major vulnerabilities here. I think the stock market is certainly overvalued, and you mentioned a guest that you had that said it was extremely overvalued. Yeah, you can, you know, I wouldn't argue with that, but typically in order to get stocks, in order to create a major catastrophe, you need a catalyst. And yeah, that could happen in Europe. That could happen, I don't know, I guess in Russia, the Ukraine. I'm not sure exactly what form it would take there. It could certainly happen in Saudi Arabia with ISIS, et cetera. But, you know, absent a catalyst, you're not really going to see a downturn in the market. I mean, and, you know, $50 oil, remember, came after the market started falling. That was basically in, I think, 2009. We had $50 oil, and then it quickly shot up again to 70, 80, and then eventually about 120. And then, you know, you've had this downturn, and the downturn is very curious. I mean, it certainly has a far different look to it than it did in 2008, 2009.
As this discussion winds down a bit, just touch on the interesting development with the ruble market. You know, we saw cracks in the seams in that currency, and you alluded to currency weakness with the dollar soaring, resulted from the oil implosion. And we saw gold increase by just over 100% in just 7 weeks' time. I've been posing this to the guests on the show, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about the abruptness of that climb and whether or not we might see something similar in terms of gold relative to dollars in the coming years.
Oh, I think you definitely will. I mean, I think that, you know, again, when gold starts going, I mean, you'll know it. And it'll be absolutely, you know, breathtaking. And, you know, people won't take advantage of it. They'll just say, well, it'll pull back, and it won't pull back. And that's usually the hallmark of, you know, a major bull market. And that will start. I mean, you know, it could start next week, but my guess is that it's still about 18 to 24 months away before you really see it start, before you go through the old highs of what, around 1900. But as far as the ruble goes, I think I'm not bearish on the ruble right here, to be very honest. I think that oil prices are likely to come back. Sort of surprised. I know this sounds ridiculous, but I'm kind of surprised the ruble's held up as well as it has. And I think one reason it's not at 100 rather than 65, the Chinese. I think the Chinese have been very active in Russia, and I think they've created sort of a floor in the Russian economy. And I think that's part of their Eurasian, Middle Eastern, Eastern strategy. And that's you know, what I think about the ruble. I wouldn't mind owning the ruble. I mean, I would be a buyer rather than a seller of the ruble right now today. And the other thing that could happen with the ruble is it might end up as part of a currency basket with the yuan and maybe even the mark if the euro breaks away. I mean, these are not predictions, you know, per se. Possibilities that can happen in the kind of world that we live in. I mean, you really can't rule out a whole lot of stuff, but you cannot rule out a new currency basket in which the ruble and the yuan and the mark and maybe some other currencies share a role and are convertible into gold. And you have, again, a Bretton Woods type of monetary system that at least governs the eastern part of the world and may, you know, spread to the west. So that anything is on the table, almost anything is on the table here. I mean, it's very difficult to see how things are going to play out other than to say that this is the time in which things are changing. You know, my friends were disturbing. It's a very, very disturbing, distressing, upsetting world that we're living in today on so many different levels, in so many different ways. And typically, these kinds of situations give birth to, you know, a new world order. And I think that's exactly what we're going to see over the next 5 years.
Bretton Woods Part 2. What an interesting thought. This is food for cogitation. I know my listeners are going to be digesting this discussion for some time. Dr. Stephen Leeb, we want to thank you.
Always my pleasure. I really like talking to you so much.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. There has been some limited discussion in mainstream media about the apparent mistake made by the Fed in accidentally publishing internal staff forecasts for interest rates, unemployment, and other key indicators on their website late last month. Typically, the Federal Reserve waits 5 years to publish such information. But in what is being called a slip-up, staff forecasts were added to the Fed's public site on June 29th. So not only have officials been able to evaluate this data, everyone else with a laptop and an internet connection can as well. What you'll find is the following. The Fed expects the federal funds rate to be at 0.35% by the end of this year. Rates are seen rising to 1.26% by the end of 2016, and then rising to 2.12% by the end of 2017. By the end of 2020, the rate is expected to be 3.34%. What a great way to front-run and psychologically manage interest rate expectations than to inadvertently release them in advance for the next 5 years. Accidents like this do not happen on this level. In a MarketWatch article, Stephen Stanley, chief economist at Amherst Pierpont Securities, was quoted as saying, "As I look at the forecast, I can't help but conclude all of these PhD economists on the board staff are wasting a lot of time running these models. How can real growth exceed potential by over 0.5% for the next 3 years, but the unemployment rate magically stabilizes at exactly the full employment level? The model released by the Fed shows that the staff is forcing the model to split out forecasts that show upcoming inflation under 2%. He commented, "Do you get the impression, as I do, that the staff gathers in a room and decides what the results should be, and then tortures the model, or at least uses fudge factors until they get to the results that they were determined to achieve? Why bother with extensive, complicated models if you are just going to manipulate the result? Because the model provides at least the illusion of rigor and objectivity." The illusion of rigor and objectivity. That's exactly what it is. An illusion. This model reminds me of a mind-reading trick I bought in the 1970s. When they started selling scientific calculators, three people would each randomly input a four-digit number into a calculator. A fourth person would then total their inputs and announce the randomly derived number, which was a five-digit number. The first two numbers in the sequence represented a page number. The second two numbers represented a line number. The third number represented a position from left to right. There were a stack of books on the table. The person picked up a book, opened it to that page, counted down to that line, and counted across to that word. When the person announced the word, it matched a word that was pre-written on a blackboard and was revealed at that moment. A pretty amazing illusion for the 1970s, but it's easy when you know how it's done. The calculator was gimmicked. It was hotwired so that it could be pre-programmed, so that no matter what numbers were input, they always came out with the predetermined five-digit answer that was used to identify one particular word in the book. I'm happy to share that simple magician's method with you because the psychological levels of sophistication since the 1970s have advanced significantly to the point where that same illusion can fool you many times over today, because the methods are so much more sophisticated and refined. But let's refocus on the Fed's somewhat antiquated and unbelievable financial models for the information they supposedly, inadvertently released. Are their methods convincing or fooling anyone? I think not. Will they use these to posture against in each of the coming years? Of course. But it's a worn-out magic trick that is going to fool less and less people as time goes on, because we are facing significant debt issues the world over that eventually cannot be papered over. They can for now, it seems, but that will only last until it can't. And that day is getting closer by the minute. Remember, there are lies, damned lies, and those inadvertently released Fed projections. You be the judge. Chris, I'd like to urge all of our listeners to sign up for my email list at conquerchange.com. Several years ago, our listeners will recall I hosted a series of teleseminars on gold and the economy, and I'll soon begin hosting a series of free Conquer Change webinars. So please sign up at conquerchange.com. And until next time, this is Robert Ian, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at Conquer Change. Thanks, Chris.